"I'm afraid that you'll never be human," she said. "So I'm sure that I have no rival. And if I have, which I doubt, darling, I don't think I'll worry about it. Because if it's a person who's always available on call without appointment, well, everybody knows what sort of a person that is." He thought that he would have to be careful. He had been about to slap her face. "Lillian, I think you know," he said, "that humor of this kind is more than I can stand."
"Oh, you're so serious," she laughed. "I keep forgetting it. You're so serious about everything, particularly yourself."
Then she whirled to him suddenly, her smile gone. She had the strange pleading look, which he had seen in her face at times, a look that seemed made of sincerity and courage.
"You prefer to be serious, Henry? All right. How long do you wish me to exist somewhere in the basement of your life? How lonely do you want me to become? I've asked nothing of you. I've let you live your life as you pleased. Can't you give me one evening? Oh, I know you hate parties and you'll be bored, but it means a great deal to me. Call it empty social vanity. I want to appear for once with my husband. I suppose you never think of it in such terms, but you're an important man. You're envied, hated, respected, and feared. You're a man whom any woman would be proud to show off as her husband. You may say it's a low form of feminine ostentation, but that's the form of any woman's happiness. You don't live by such standards, but I do. Can't you give me this much, at the price of a few hours of boredom? Can't you be strong enough to fulfill your obligation and to perform a husband's duty? Can't you go there not for your own sake but mine? Not because you want to go, but only because I want it?"
Dagny, he thought desperately. Dagny, who had never said a word about his life at home, who had never made a claim, uttered a reproach, or asked a question. He could not appear before her with his wife. He could not let her see him as the husband being proudly shown off. He wished he could die now in this moment, before he committed this action, because he knew that he would commit it, because he had accepted his secret as guilt and promised himself to take its consequences, because he had granted that the right was with Lillian, and he was able to bear any form of damnation, but not able to deny the right when it was claimed of him, because he knew that the reason for his refusal to go was the reason that gave him no right to refuse. Because he heard the pleading cry in his mind, "Oh God, Lillian, anything but that party!" And he did not allow himself to beg for mercy. He said evenly, his voice lifeless and firm, "All right, Lillian, I'll go." The wedding veil of Rose Point lace caught on the splintered floor of her tenement bedroom. Cheryl Brooks lifted it cautiously, stepping to look at herself in a crooked mirror that hung on the wall. She had been photographed here all day, as she had been many times in the past 2 months. She still smiled with incredulous gratitude when newspaper people wanted to take her picture, but she wished they would not do it so often. An aging sob sister who had a drippy love column in print and the bitter wisdom of a policewoman in person had taken Cheryl under her protection weeks ago, when the girl had first been thrown into press interviews as into a meat grinder. Today the sob sister had chased the reporters out, had snapped, all right, beat it," at the neighbors, had slammed Cheryl's door in their faces, and had helped her to dress. She was to drive Cheryl to the wedding. She had discovered that there was no one else to do it. The wedding veil, the white satin gown, the delicate slippers and the strand of pearls at her throat had cost 500 times the price of the entire contents of Cheryl's room. A bed took most of the room's space, and the rest was taken by a chest of drawers, one chair, and her few dresses hanging behind a faded curtain. The huge hoop skirt of the wedding gown brushed against the walls when she moved, her slender figure swaying above the skirt in the dramatic contrast of a tight, severe, long-sleeved bodice. The gown had been made by the best designer in the city. "You see, when I got the job in the dime store, I could have moved to a better room," she said to the sob sister in apology. "But I don't think it matters much where you sleep at night, so I save my money because I'll need it for something important in the future." She stopped and smiled, shaking her head dazedly. "I thought I'd need it," she said. "You look fine," said the sob sister. "You can't see much in that alleged mirror, but you're okay. The way all this happened, I haven't had time to catch up with myself, but you see, Jim is wonderful. He doesn't mind it, that I'm only a sales girl from a dime store living in a place like this. He doesn't hold it against me." "Uh-huh," said the sob sister. Her face looked grim. Cheryl remembered the wonder of the first time Jim Taggart had come here. He had come one evening without warning, a month after their first meeting, when she had given up hope of ever seeing him again. She had been miserably embarrassed. She had felt as if she were trying to hold a sunrise within the space of a mud puddle. But Jim had smiled, sitting on her only chair, looking at her flushed face and at her room. Then he had told her to put on her coat, and he had taken her to dinner at the most expensive restaurant in the city. He had smiled at her uncertainty, at her awkwardness, at her terror of picking the wrong fork, and at the look of enchantment in her eyes. She had not known what he thought, but he had known that she was stunned, not by the place, but by his bringing her there, that she barely touched the costly food, that she took the dinner, not as booty from a rich sucker, as all the girls he knew would have taken it, but as some shining award she had never expected to deserve. He had come back to her 2 weeks later, and then their dates had grown progressively more frequent. He would drive up to the dime store at the closing hour, and she would see her fellow salesgirls gaping at her, at his limousine, at the uniformed chauffeur who opened the door for her. He would take her to the best nightclubs, and when he introduced her to his friends, he would say, "Miss Brooks works in the dime store in Madison Square." She would see the strange expressions on their faces, and Jim watching them with a hint of mockery in his eyes. He wanted to spare her the need of pretense or embarrassment, she thought with gratitude. He had the strength to be honest, and not to care whether others approved of him or not, she thought with admiration. But she felt an odd burning pain, new to her. The night she heard some woman who worked for a highbrow political magazine say to her companion at the next table, "How generous of Jim!" Had he wished, she would have given him the only kind of payment she could offer in return. She was grateful that he did not seek it. But she felt as if their relationship was an immense debt, and she had nothing to pay it with except her silent worship. He did not need her worship, she thought. There were evenings when he came to take her out, but remained in her room instead and talked to her, while she listened in silence. It always happened unexpectedly, with a kind of peculiar abruptness, as if he had not intended doing it, but something burst within him, and he had to speak. Then he sat slumped on her bed, unaware of his surroundings and of her presence, yet his eyes jerked to her face once in a while, as if he had to be certain that a living being heard him. "It wasn't for myself, it wasn't for myself at all. Why won't they believe me, those people? I had to grant the union's demands to cut down the trains, and the moratorium on bonds was the only way I could do it, so that's why Wesley gave it to me, for the workers, not for myself. All the newspapers said that I was a great example for all businessmen to follow, a businessman with a sense of social responsibility, that's what they said. It's true, isn't it? Isn't it? What was wrong about that moratorium? What if we did skip a few technicalities? It was for a good purpose. Everyone agrees that anything you do is good, so long as it's not for yourself. But she won't give me credit for a good purpose. She doesn't think anybody's any good except herself. My sister is a ruthless, conceited bitch who won't take anyone's ideas but her own. Why do they keep looking at me that way, she and Reardon and all those people? Why are they so sure they're right? If I acknowledge their superiority in the material realm, why don't they acknowledge mine in the spiritual? They have the brain, but I have the heart. They have the capacity to produce wealth, but I have the capacity to love. Isn't mine the greater capacity? Hasn't it been recognized as the greatest through all the centuries of human history? Why won't they recognize it? Why are they so sure they're great? And if they're great and I'm not, isn't that exactly why they should bow to me because I'm not? Wouldn't that be an act of true humanity? It takes no kindness to respect a man who deserves respect. It's only a payment which he's earned. To give an unearned respect is the supreme gesture of charity. But they're incapable of charity. They're not human. They feel no concern for anyone's need or weakness. No concern and no pity. She could understand little of it. But she understood that he was unhappy and that somebody had hurt him. He saw the pain of tenderness in her face, the pain of indignation against his enemies, and he saw the glance intended for heroes, given to him by a person able to experience the emotion behind that glance. She did not know why she felt certain that she was the only one to whom he could confess his torture. She took it as a special honor, as one more gift. The only way to be worthy of him, she thought, was never to ask him for anything. He offered her money once, and she refused it, with such a bright, painful flare of anger in her eyes that he did not attempt it again. The anger was at herself. She wondered whether she had done something to make him think she was that kind of person. But she did not want to be ungrateful for his concern, or to embarrass him by her ugly poverty. She wanted to show him her eagerness to rise and justify his favor. So she told him that he could help her if he wished, by helping her to find a better job. He did not answer. In the weeks that followed, she waited, but he never mentioned the subject. She blamed herself. She thought that she had offended him, that he had taken it as an attempt to use him. When he gave her an emerald bracelet, she was too shocked to understand. Trying desperately not to hurt him, she pleaded that she could not accept it. "Why not?" he asked. "It isn't as if you were a bad woman paying the usual price for it. Are you afraid that I'll start making demands? Don't you trust me?" He laughed aloud at her stammering embarrassment. He smiled with an odd kind of enjoyment all through the evening when they went to a nightclub, and she wore the bracelet with her shabby black dress. He made her wear that bracelet again on the night when he took her to a party, a great reception given by Mrs. Cornelius Pope. If he considered her good enough to bring into the home of his friends, she thought, the illustrious friends whose names she had seen on the inaccessible mountain peaks that were the society columns of the newspapers, she could not embarrass him by wearing her old dress. She spent her year's savings on an evening gown of bright green chiffon with a low neckline, a belt of yellow roses, and a rhinestone buckle. When she entered the Stern residence with the cold, brilliant lights and a terrace suspended over the roofs of skyscrapers, she knew that her dress was wrong for the occasion, though she could not tell why. But she kept her posture proudly straight, and she smiled with the courageous trust of a kitten when it sees a hand extended to play. People gathered to have a good time would not hurt anyone, she thought. At the end of an hour, her attempt to smile had become a helpless, bewildered plea. Then the smile went as she watched the people around her. She saw that the trim, confident girls had a nasty insolence of manner when they spoke to Jim, as if they did not respect him and never had. One of them in particular, a Betty Pope, the daughter of the hostess, kept making remarks to him which Cheryl could not understand, because she could not believe that she understood them correctly. No one had paid any attention to her at first, except for a few astonished glances at her gown. After a while, she saw them looking at her. She heard an elderly woman ask Jim in the anxious tone of referring to some distinguished family she had missed knowing. "Did you say Miss Brooks, of Madison Square?" She saw an odd smile on Jim's face when he answered, making his voice sound peculiarly clear. "Yes, the cosmetics counter of Raleigh's 5 and 10. Then she saw some people becoming too polite to her, and others moving away in a pointed manner, and most of them being senselessly awkward in simple bewilderment, and Jim watching silently with that odd smile. She tried to get out of the way, out of their notice. As she slipped by along the edge of the room, she heard some man say with a shrug, "Well, Jim Taggart is one of the most powerful men in Washington at the moment." He did not say it respectfully. Out on the terrace, where it was darker, she heard two men talking and wondered why she felt certain that they were talking about her. One of them said, "Taggart can afford to do it if he pleases." And the other said something about the horse of some Roman emperor named Caligula. She looked at the lone, straight shaft of the Taggart building rising in the distance. And then she thought that she understood. These people hated Jim because they envied him. Whatever they were, she thought, whatever their names and their money, none of them had an achievement comparable to his. None of them had defied the whole country to build a railroad everybody thought impossible. For the first time, she saw that she did have something to offer Jim. These people were as mean and small as the people from whom she had escaped in Buffalo. He was as lonely as she had always been, and the sincerity of her feeling was the only recognition he had found. Then she walked back into the ballroom, cutting straight through the crowd, and the only thing left of the tears she had tried to hold back in the darkness of the terrace was the fiercely luminous sparkle of her eyes. If he wished to stand by her openly, even though she was only a shop girl, if he wished to flaunt it, if he had brought her here to face the indignation of his friends, then it was the gesture of a courageous man defying their opinion, and she was willing to match his courage by serving as the scarecrow of the occasion. But she was glad when it was over, when she sat beside him in his car driving home through the darkness. She felt a bleak kind of relief. Her battling defiance ebbed into a strange, desolate feeling. She tried not to give way to it. Jim said little. He sat looking sullenly out the car window. She wondered whether she had disappointed him in some manner. On the stoop of her rooming house, she said to him forlornly, "I'm sorry if I let you down." He did not answer for a moment, and then he asked, "What would you say if I asked you to marry me?" She looked at him. She looked around them. There was a filthy mattress hanging on somebody's windowsill, a pawn shop across the street, a garbage pail at the stoop beside them. One did not ask such a question in such a place. She did not know what it meant, and she answered, "I guess I haven't any sense of humor. This is a proposal, my dear." Then this was the way they reached their first kiss, with tears running down her face, tears unshed at the party, tears of shock, of happiness, of thinking that this should be happiness, and of a low, desolate voice telling her that this was not the way she would have wanted it to happen. She had not thought about the newspapers until the day when Jim told her to come to his apartment, and she found it crowded with people who had notebooks, cameras, and flashbulbs. When she saw her picture in the papers for the first time, a picture of them together, Jim's arm around her, she giggled with delight and wondered proudly whether every person in the city had seen it. After a while, the delight vanished. They kept photographing her at the dime store counter, in the subway, on the stoop of the tenement house, in her miserable room. She would have taken money from Jim now and run to hide in some obscure hotel for the weeks of their engagement, but he did not offer it. He seemed to want her to remain where she was. They printed pictures of Jim at his desk, in the concourse of the Taggart Terminal, by the steps of his private railway car, at a formal banquet in Washington. The huge spreads of full newspaper pages, the articles and magazines, the radio voices, the newsreels, were all a single long, sustained scream about the Cinderella girl and the Democratic businessman. She told herself not to be suspicious when she felt uneasy. She told herself not to be ungrateful when she felt hurt. She felt it only in a few rare moments, when she awakened in the middle of the night and lay in the silence of her room, unable to sleep. She knew that it would take her years to recover, to believe, to understand. She was reeling through her days like a person with a sunstroke, seeing nothing but the figure of Jim Taggart, as she had seen him first, on the night of his great triumph. "Listen, kid," the sob sister said to her when she stood in her room for the last time, the lace of the wedding veil streaming like crystal foam from her hair to the blotched planks of the floor. "You think that if one gets hurt in life, it's through one's own sins. And that's true in the long run. But there are people who'll try to hurt you through the good they see in you, knowing that it's the good, needing it, and punishing you for it. Don't let it break you when you discover that." "I don't think I'm afraid," she said, looking intently straight before her, the radiance of her smile melting the earnestness of her glance. "I have no right to be afraid of anything. I'm too happy. You see, I always thought that there wasn't any sense in people saying that all you can do in life is suffer. I wasn't going to knuckle down to that and give up. I thought that things could happen which were beautiful and very great. I didn't expect it to happen to me. Not so much and so soon. But I'll try to live up to it." "Money is the root of all evil," said James Taggart. "Money can't buy happiness. Love will conquer any barrier and any social distance. That may be a bromide, boys, but that's how I feel." He stood under the lights of the ballroom of the Wayne Falkland Hotel in a circle of reporters who had closed about him the moment the wedding ceremony ended. He heard the crowd of guests beating like a tide beyond the circle. Cheryl stood beside him, her white-gloved hand on the black of his sleeve. She was still trying to hear the words of the ceremony, not quite believing that she had heard them. "How do you feel, Mrs. Taggart?" She heard the question from somewhere in the circle of reporters. It was like the jolt of returning to consciousness. Two words suddenly made everything real to her. She smiled and whispered, choking,
I
I'm very happy.
At opposite ends of the ballroom, Orrin Boyle, who seemed too stout for his full dress clothes, and Bertram Scudder, who seemed too meager for his, surveyed the crowd of guests with the same thought, though neither of them admitted that he was thinking it. Orrin Boyle half told himself that he was looking for the faces of friends, and Bertram Scudder suggested to himself that he was gathering material for an article. But both, unknown to each other, were drawing a mental chart of the faces they saw, classifying them under two headings which, if named, would have read favor and fear. There were men whose presence signified a special protection extended to James Taggart, and men whose presence confessed a desire to avoid his hostility. Those who represented a hand lowered to pull him up, and those who represented a back bent to let him climb. By the unwritten code of the day, nobody received or accepted an invitation from a man of public prominence, except in token of one or the other of these motives. Those in the first group were, for the most part, youthful. They had come from Washington. Those in the second group were older. They were businessmen. Orrin Boyle and Bertram Scudder were men who used words as a public instrument, to be avoided in the privacy of one's own mind. Words were a commitment, carrying implications which they did not wish to face. They needed no words for their chart. The classification was done by physical means. A respectful movement of their eyebrows, equivalent to the emotion of the word, so, for the first group, and a sarcastic movement of their lips, equivalent to the emotion of, well, well, for the second. One face blew up the smooth working of their calculating mechanisms for a moment. When they saw the cold blue eyes and blonde hair of Hank Reardon, their muscles tore at the register of the second group in the equivalent of, oh boy. The sum of the chart was an estimate of James Taggart's power. It added up to an impressive total. They knew that James Taggart was fully aware of it when they saw him moving among his guests. He walked briskly, in a Morse code pattern of short dashes and brief stops, with a manner of faint irritation, as if conscious of the number of people whom his displeasure might worry. The hint of a smile on his face had a flavor of gloating, as if he knew that the act of coming to honor him was an act that disgraced the men who had come, as if he knew and enjoyed it. A tail of figures kept trailing and shifting behind him, as if their function were to give him the pleasure of ignoring them. Mr. Moen flickered briefly among the tail, and Dr. Pritchett and Balfe Eubank. The most persistent one was Paul Larkin. He kept describing circles around Taggart, as if trying to acquire a suntan by means of an occasional ray, his wistful smile pleading to be noticed. Taggart's eyes swept over the crowd once in a while, swiftly and furtively, in the manner of a prowler's flashlight. This, in the muscular shorthand, legible to Orrin Boyle, meant that Taggart was looking for someone, and did not want anyone to know it. The search ended when Eugene Lawson came to shake Taggart's hand, and to say, his wet lower lip twisting like a cushion to soften the blow, "Mr. Mooch couldn't come, Jim. Mr. Mooch is so sorry. He had a special plane chartered, but at the last minute things came up. Crucial national problems, you know." Taggart stood still, did not answer, and frowned. Orrin Boyle burst out laughing. Taggart turned to him so sharply that the others melted away without waiting for a command to vanish. "What do you think you're doing?" snapped Taggart.
"Having a good time, Jimmy, just having a good time," said Boyle. "Wesley is your boy, wasn't he?"
"I know someone who's my boy, and he'd better not forget it."
"Who, Larkin?" "Well, no, I don't think you're talking about Larkin. And if it's not Larkin that you're talking about, why, then I think you ought to be careful in your use of the possessive pronouns. I don't mind the age classification. I know I look young for my years, but I'm just allergic to pronouns."
"That's very smart, but you're going to get too smart one of these days."
"If I do, you just go ahead and make the most of it, Jimmy. If."
"The trouble with people who overreach themselves is that they have short memories. You'd better remember who got Reardon metal choked off the market for you."
"Why, I remember who promised to. That was the party who then pulled every string he could lay his hands on to try to prevent that particular directive from being issued, because he figured he might need rail of Reardon metal in the future.
Because you spent $10,000 pouring liquor into people you hoped would prevent the directive about the bond moratorium."
"That's right, so I did. I had friends who had railroad bonds, and besides, I have friends in Washington, too, Jimmy. Well, your friends beat mine on that moratorium business, but mine beat yours on Reardon metal, and I'm not forgetting it. But what the hell, it's all right with me. That's the way to share things around. Only don't you try to fool me, Jimmy. Save the act for the suckers.
If you don't believe that I've always tried to do my best for you...
Sure you have. The best that could be expected, all things considered. And you'll continue to do it, too, so long as I've got somebody you need. And not a minute longer. So I just wanted to remind you that I've got my own friends in Washington. Friends that money can't buy. Just like yours, Jimmy.
What do you think you mean?
Just what you're thinking. The ones you buy aren't really worth the damn because somebody can always offer them more. So the field's wide open to anybody, and it's just like old-fashioned competition again. But if you get the goods on a man, then you've got him. Then there's no higher bidder, and you can count on his friendship. Well, you have friends, and so have I. You have friends I can use, and vice versa. That's all right with me. What the hell? One's got to trade something. If we don't trade money, and the age of money is past, then we trade men.
What is it you're driving at?
Why, I'm just telling you a few things that you ought to remember. Now take Wesley, for instance. You promised him the assistant's job in the Bureau of National Planning for double-crossing Reardon at the time of the Equalization of Opportunity Bill. You had the connections to do it, and that's what I asked you to do, in exchange for the anti-dog-eat-dog rule where I had the connections. So Wesley did his part, and you saw to it that you got it all on paper. Oh, sure, I know that you've got written proof of the kind of deals he pulled to help pass that bill, while he was taking Reardon's money to defeat it and keeping Reardon off guard. They were pretty ugly deals. It would be pretty messy for Mr. Mooch if it all came out in public. So you kept your promise, and you got the job for him, because you thought you had him, and so you did, and he paid off pretty handsomely, didn't he? But it works only just so long. After a while, Mr. Wesley Mooch might get to be so powerful, and the scandal so old, that nobody will care how he got his start or whom he double-crossed. Nothing lasts forever. Wesley was Reardon's man, and then he was your man. And he might be somebody else's man tomorrow.
Are you giving me a hint?
Why, no, I'm giving you a friendly warning. We're old friends, Jimmy, and I think that that's what we ought to remain. I think we can be very useful to each other, you and I, if you don't start getting the wrong ideas about friendship. Me? I believe in a balance of power.
Did you prevent Mooch from coming here tonight?
Well, maybe I did and maybe I didn't. I'll let you worry about it. That's good for me if I did, and still better if I didn't.
Cheryl's eyes followed James Taggart through the crowd. The faces that kept shifting and gathering around her seemed so friendly, and their voices were so eagerly warm, that she felt certain there was no malice anywhere in the room. She wondered why some of them talked to her about Washington, in a hopeful, confidential manner of half-sentences, half-hints, as if they were seeking her help for something secret she was supposed to understand. She did not know what to say, but she smiled and answered whatever she pleased. She could not disgrace the person of Mrs. Taggart by any touch of fear. Then she saw the enemy. He was a tall, slender figure in a gray evening gown, who was now her sister-in-law. The pressure of anger in Cheryl's mind was the stored accumulation of the sounds of Jim's tortured voice. She felt the nagging pull of a duty left undone. Her eyes kept returning to the enemy and studying her intently. The pictures of Dagny Taggart in the newspapers had shown a figure dressed in slacks, or a face with a slanting hat brim and a raised coat collar. Now she wore a gray evening gown that seemed indecent, because it looked austerely modest. So modest that it vanished from one's awareness and left one too aware of the slender body it pretended to cover. There was a tone of blue in the gray cloth that went with the gunmetal gray of her eyes. She wore no jewelry, only a bracelet on her wrist, a chain of heavy metal links with a green-blue cast. Cheryl waited until she saw Dagny standing alone, then tore forward, cutting resolutely across the room. She looked at close range into the gunmetal eyes that seemed cold and intense at once, the eyes that looked at her directly with a polite, impersonal curiosity. "There's something I want you to know," said Cheryl, her voice taut and harsh, "so that there won't be any pretending about it. I'm not going to put on the sweet relative act. I know what you've done to Jim and how you've made him miserable all his life. I'm going to protect him against you,
I'll put you in your place. I'm Mrs. Taggart. I'm the woman in this family now.
That's quite all right, said Dagny. I'm the man. Cheryl watched her walk away and thought that Jim had been right. This sister of his was a creature of cold evil, who had given her no response, no acknowledgment, no emotion of any kind except a touch of something that looked like an astonished, indifferent amusement.